Welcome to The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Today's show is absolutely one of my favorite episodes ever. I talked with Chef Andrew Gruhl, who just might be the patron saint of restaurateurs, small business owners, and service workers during the pandemic. Gruhl is the founder and owner of Slapfish, a growing national fast casual restaurant chain based in Huntington Beach, California. He's a widely recognized culinary innovator and familiar face on the Food Network and other cooking channels. Over the past year, he's also gained prominence as an unabashed critic of arbitrary rules that put businessmen like him at the beck and call of hypocritical politicians like Gavin Newsom. Most famously, in an absolutely inspired rant that went viral on social media last December, Gruhl listed all the ways in which California's ban on outdoor dining made no sense before concluding on camera, "I'm not an asshole, the governor is." Gruhl's no slouch when it comes to helping food workers who have been displaced by the pandemic and lockdowns and ill-served by state welfare agencies. He and his wife created a fund to help unemployed workers that's given out hundreds of thousands of dollars so far. I sat down to talk with Gruhl about what it's been like to run a business with government at all levels arbitrarily flipping the on-off switch, why innovation is central to both capitalism and cuisine, and why he'll never open another franchise in California. Here is The Reason Interview with Andrew Gruhl.
Andrew Gruhl, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me.
So summarize how difficult this year has been running a food business.
It's been all about the extremes, extreme highs and extreme lows. Everything this year is living on one end of the spectrum or the other.
You have, you've emerged over the past year as a real vocal critic of arbitrary kind of government regulations and in all sorts of ways. What are the things that make it more difficult? I mean, running a restaurant is a fantastically difficult operation to begin with in the best of circumstances. What are the types of things that have made it that much more difficult for you to operate?
Well, already I talked about the fact before the pandemic that the excess amount of regulation, especially here in California, has inhibited our ability to grow, to employ more people, to help the local economy.
So let's stop with that. We're pre-pandemic.
Yep.
What are the things that, I mean, because your Slapfish is doing well, you're growing, you could be growing faster. What's keeping it from doing that?
Well, number one, we are a franchise concept. So franchise law, especially in California, is getting more and more cumbersome year on year. This is a registration state, a lot of money that's required in order to grow and franchise. So we cannot actually expand within the state of California unless we can either get independent investment or really private equity money. I mean, that's the only option out there. So we've kind of here locally with our stores, this was an old bagel shop. Well, actually, this side was a Menchie's. That side was an old bagel shop. We've had to really scrap together and bootstrap in order to continue to survive in California. We do so because we love the clientele. We love the environment. We're in Surf City, USA. It goes hand in hand with our kind of mission surrounding marine stewardship. But it certainly is a difficult state to own a restaurant. We will not grow in California the same ways that we're going to continue to grow.
Pre-pandemic, what about labor laws? Is that a big part of it as well? And how does that, you know, what are the rules on employment that make it more difficult to kind of grow?
Yeah, I mean, in California, the cost of labor is at least 5% higher than what you're going to see in any other market in the United States. And I know that because we're in 8 or 9 different states. So we can kind of look at these numbers in a true comparison, and always cost of goods, cost of labor is going to run collectively 8 to 10% higher in California.
Can I ask or push back a little bit? But people are willing to pay a premium to live in California because it's, you know, particularly in Southern California near the ocean, and we're, you know, only a couple hundred yards from that. Of course, it's going to cost more. What's the problem?
Well, people are willing to pay a premium for certain things, real estate, retail clothing. When it comes to food, that's not the case. There's a national price and that's it. People are going to look on menus online at our Utah store, and they're going to say that California, we're trying to take advantage of the customer.
Is part of the problem, if the government is raising the costs of, you know, providing goods and services, does that, I mean, it makes it easier if you want to go national, if you want to go big in California, you're going to be more like Chili's or, you know, Fuddruckers or something. I mean, like, does that hurt the artisanal business? Because you're now you, in order to raise the capital, you've got to grow your market bigger. And so you're pitching to a broader clientele.
Let me put it to you this way. So if I start a business in California, I pay the franchise tax board X amount of dollars, no matter what, no matter the size of my business. So a small business pays $1,000, a huge business pays $1,000. You're financially incentivized in the state of California to be a massive business because it's all about economies of scale. It's about revenue. So if I'm going to make 1% on $500,000 or I'm going to make 1% on $500 million, I've got to go the $500 million route because I need that small margin on a massive revenue number. So consolidating business in California is really the only way to survive.
And that seems to be going at odds with everything, not just in kind of cuisine, but almost all aspects of American life over the past 20, 30, 50 years of going to small scale production, right? More individualized, more tailored, more weird, more artisanal.
But it goes against the economic calculus in states like California, because you can't be small scale because then you can't survive. The barrier of entry is way too high. People do it anyways, thinking that, okay, well, I'm going to use this as a beta and I will scale, right? So in the mindset of the entrepreneur in California, scale is inherent in that mindset, and it has to be. Whereas the mindset of an entrepreneur in, say, Texas is, I'm just going to build a local restaurant, a local community restaurant, and you don't necessarily need to scale in order to survive.
What would it take? You raised Texas, which is the specter that is haunting California, right? Mm-hmm. Texas, yeah. Maybe Florida. You know, you're a successful businessman here. You're very rooted in your local community. What would it take for you to say, screw it, I'm going to Texas? Is there something? Because this goes to the question of how much blood can California get out of you, right?
Yeah. That's just not my nature.
Yeah.
But I do think, and I know for a fact, that's what hundreds of other people are doing, is they're finding a Texas or they're finding an Arizona. You know, I wouldn't go Texas, right? I would go to South Dakota. I would go to Alaska, right? Because for me, it's also just about the general frontier, if you will, new towns, new development, not second generation, third, fourth, fifth, sixth generation. I think, frankly, you know, to use the oil pun, I think Texas is tapped out to some degree on the retail side of things.
Let's talk about COVID and pandemic. California, you had the first in the country shelter in place or stay in place laws. How did that affect your business? And was there a call for, you know, restaurants or businesses taking a hit because of the pandemic?
Yeah, so California, obviously, it was easy for California to just shut everything down. And it was also easy for the people of California to accept that shutdown. And that was what was really interesting.
But why do you say that?
Well, because we're used to being told by the government what to do. It's inherent in our DNA here in California.
So it's a state of sheeple. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to use the sheep cliche because I also don't want to dumb down the intellect in California. I do not think it's a dumb.
You don't
state.
Want to speak ill of sheep either. They're very tasty.
And I just took my sweater off a few minutes ago. I have one underneath too. So the interesting thing, though, is that it comes in phases, right? So what we saw in California in phases was the first 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks of the lockdown. We frankly, we're all living the cliche that we were in it together. I mean, you know, I was supporting the lockdown to some degree within the restaurant space because we all didn't know what was happening, right? So it was this fact-finding mission for a few weeks, right? We all know, flatten the curve, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody was kind of in it. So our first pivot, once we got shut down, was, okay, what can we do as a restaurant? And this is how our mindset goes as business owners. What can we do to help the community? So we opened up for feeding all the kids who couldn't get school lunches, all first responders, all of them, right? Anybody in the medical community, which is hilarious, side note, because people started buying scrubs and coming in here for free lobster rolls to take advantage of that. It's amazing how creative people can be. Yeah. Dollar for a pair of scrubs. But then over time, right, we started to learn a little bit more, and then it was more lockdown, more restriction, more really it was about crushing the mindset of the consumer. Not intentionally. I'm not saying that was the intentional goal, but after about a month, the fear set in, and then it just starts to germinate in the community, right? In the behavior of people within the community.
Meaning that they weren't coming out for food, or the...
No, they weren't coming out. And if you just do a general sample across social platforms on a hyper-local level, that's where you can really kind of see through the conversation how scared people were to actually go out. You know, just the stories about the incessant need to wipe down every single grocery that comes in the door. And
all of which, I mean, I guess it's kind of understandable because people didn't know, but then it all kind of gets revealed as superstitious behavior that has nothing to do with.
But at that point, people still, you don't break that conditioning.
What, you also started, you and your wife started a GoFundMe for restaurant workers who were put out of work. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you're, one of the persistent themes of your critique of how things have been done is that, you know, restaurant workers weren't really being considered in a lot of these roles, and also that regulators seem to think restaurants are in the business of poisoning people. That you know, if they don't have their boot on your neck, you're going to be selling rotten food or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it goes beyond the restaurant space, right? But what we saw time and time and time again is with every lockdown, there was a massive sect of people who were losing their jobs. And it was just this glib, ho-hum attitude from the government's locking us down, you know, because people over profits, right? These sound bites were just constantly being masqueraded around to make the business owners and the workers within the industries that were being vilified feel guilty. So specifically, the restaurant industry was being vilified as a vector of spread for coronavirus. And if you viscerally, it makes sense. You've got these small spaces where people are on top of one another, and therefore they have to be these vectors of spread, right? But then when you actually pull apart the layers and you think about it, restaurants are inherently adapt to, we're trained to be safe and sanitary. Every single restaurant worker has a food handler's card. Within that food handler's card and that certification, you learn everything from all the various steps of entry, service, etc., through the restaurant, from bacteria, material data safety sheets, you name it, right? We are basically, you know, on the front line of trying to create environments that are safe and sanitary. That's what we do. But yet, we are now being vilified as the vectors of spread when, frankly, the data didn't show that.
Right. Which goes into, you know, when outdoor dining was allowed, mm-hmm. It turned out that outdoor dining was not a vector, and actually even in many cases indoor dining, but outdoor dining, you know, how do you respond when you get shut down for outdoor dining, which is not a cause of spread? And that's like the thing that's keeping you afloat.
So let me back up, right? What we did learn is exactly that outdoor dining was the safest way to continue to try and survive. And here in Southern California, and actually across the nation, you started to see a lot of investment in things like outdoor dining patios and expanding patios to outside. But then you also did see a deregulation on things like having alcohol outside, right? Now you were allowed to take alcohol out. You were allowed to drink outside, whereas before perhaps you weren't, based upon the ABC rules. So you start to see restaurants effectively spill out into parking lots, onto streets. And it was great, right? Going into the summertime, everybody was giving everyone else a high five about this. We saw it in cold climates and hot climates. Now go into fall, winter time, Southern California is positioned to be the restaurant mecca by virtue of our weather here. Outdoor dining, you started to see restaurants pick back up again, the economic simulation, and then they shut down outdoor dining. No data, no science. And the minute they did that, I said this vocally, I said, watch, within 2 to 3 weeks of shutting down, you're going to start to see a spike, because the unintended or intended consequence of shutting down outdoor dining is you're going to drive people indoors. And I have anecdotal evidence of so many people saying, hey, we had plans to go out and dine with our weekly dining group outdoors at Javier's or whatever restaurant it is. And when they shut down outdoor dining, we all just ended up going inside and having a house party. We all got COVID, right? Cases spiked when they shut down outdoor dining. And still to this day, they will not admit the mistake associated with that. But let's now go back to the second shutdown. nobody was expecting anyone to shut down outdoor dining. That's just insane. So people had hired to be able to serve through the wintertime. And when they shut down outdoor dining, it was the last week of November here in California. It was every restaurateur's nightmare to have to let go of the majority of their staff. That's when the survival mode then kicked in, because we were already just hanging on by a thread. So you lose your entire staff, because that's the first reaction, is the variable expense of just, well, we got to let everybody go. Now, all these people who were let go, they've got to now apply for unemployment. Well, guess what? In California, because of the misappropriation of upwards of $50 billion of funds through the unemployment department here in California, they were on a total gridlock. Newsom was like, I don't know what's, you know, basically you're not getting any money. So you've got hundreds of thousands of people now applying for unemployment benefits, getting basically the middle finger by the local government. They've got no money, no job, can't get another job because all the retail industries were shut down. You're going into the holidays, can't buy Christmas gift for kids. The rent moratorium was ending, or the eviction moratorium was ending. So now, so on January 1st, they could legally get evicted. So it was just, it was a nightmare. And that's when we started our GoFundMe, because we said, look, if the government's not going to be able to help these people out, the government shuts you down. The government tells you you don't have a job anymore. Well, then fine, pay us. And that's what I said from the very beginning, is I'm not one to suggest that the government should be giving handouts, but if they are going to be the reason that our business is shut down, well, then they need to financially compensate for that.
Now, in last summer, and I think this is when you first came on my radar, your Twitter feed is fantastic, and I recommend everybody check it out. But it, you were talking about how the enhanced federal and state unemployment benefits also made it hard for you to staff your restaurant. Mm-hmm. What was going on there, and what was the unintended consequence of giving people, you know, more money to, you know, for unemployment?
Yeah, that in the very beginning, when the government offered it, I think it was $600 on top of what the state was offering for unemployment, it worked out here in California. It was about $1,100 a week, I think you could get max, right? Yeah. So we did have a lot of team members who initially we did lay everybody off because we didn't know what was going to happen. They told us we could be in the shutdown for X amount of days, what have you. But right away, as we started helping out with the community and building some business, our business came back, and we also needed those employees back. So we started reaching out to everybody. And a lot of people were like, look, I'm making $1,100 right now, not working. I've got books I want to read. I've got classes I want to take online. I'm going to really wait this thing through. I'm going to take the money as opposed to coming back and working. And what was hilarious was that when I posted that little anecdote, right, not using names, and I'm not targeting these. Look, yeah, if I was 19 years old and I was a server in a restaurant and I could make $1,500 as a server working 50 hours a week, or I could make $1,100 sitting at home, reading books, learning an instrument, all the things that you always say you want to do, heck, I would do it too. No shame on them at all. It was just the kind of the framework that was established. But when I talked about that, everybody's response to me was, well, you're not paying your employees enough. That's because you're a greedy business owner. The only reason they're not coming back is because maybe you should pay them more. No. That's not the point, right? Like I said, even if it's $2,000 that they were making by working here versus $1,100, it's merely the fact that people are being paid a significant sum of money to not work. It incentivizes that. And that's what we saw. It became virtually impossible for months to hire back employees. And this was across all of our stores.
You know, now as the pandemic seems to be lifting with vaccines rolling out, et cetera, I'm reading a lot of stuff that is saying, well, you know what, restaurants, we're bitching and moaning about this, but they're going to come back now. Do you think, is there some truth to that? Or, you know, what do you think the long-term damage will be to the kind of food service industry?
Yeah, I think that we don't know what the long-term damage is going to be yet. And I think it's way too early to start counting casualties. So this is, you know, articles right now that say, oh, well, you know, it's all over and the restaurant industry didn't do as poor as everybody thought that they were going to do, and stop feeling sorry for them. That's akin to counting casualties in a plane crash, right? The plane is crashing. Two people on the plane have a heart attack. The plane hasn't hit the ground yet. And everybody's saying, look, only two people died in this plane crash. Well, wait until the plane hits the ground, because we're free falling right now. And we don't know the effect that all of these regulations, all of these lockdowns, and all of the economic manipulation is going to have on micro industries, but or the economy as a whole in the long run. And you know, long run, short run, we could be looking at certain effects in 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. But it is my contention that we haven't seen the worst yet.
You have been outspoken in calling out, calling bullshit on politicians. You gave an impassioned kind of cri de coeur after Gavin Newsom was shown to, you know, ordering restaurants to be closed, indoor dining, showing up at the French Laundry, one of the best and certainly one of the most elite and expensive restaurants in the country. You had a pretty nice series of social media postings about John Kerry, who was flying commercial without a mask on. Talk a little bit about how the hypocrisy of people who are changing the rules on people like you and your workers and customers, you know, how does that make you feel?
Watching the people setting the rules break their own rules is the most offensive thing that's come out of this entire pandemic. But what I think is funny is that this isn't a new behavior. It's just that we haven't seen it before. We haven't necessarily all had our eyes wide open to it. The people creating rules that are crushing businesses and crushing local economies, not following their own rules and being on display, then flaunting that behavior and having a real smug response to it is the epitome of elitism. And that's what we all talk about. And we joke about how there's two categories of people. You've got the elite and then you've got the, you know, the proletariat, if you will. You've got the workers. And it couldn't be more more clear than the past 4 or 5 months, I would say, because there's almost been a bubble of safety around our elected leaders when it comes to coronavirus, from having, you know, the best healthcare, the best testing, immediate access to vaccines, right? Every single piece that's rolled out, every kind of lever that's supposed to help when it comes to the pandemic, celebrities, the uber wealthy, and our elected officials always get first dibs at.
Let's talk about your culinary genealogy. You're from New Jersey, obviously the best state in the country. When did you start becoming interested in seafood in particular?
Well, first I thought you were going to ask me whether it's Taylor ham or pork roll. but we probably shouldn't go there.
Or hoagie or sub, right? Okay. You're above the 609 area code, right? So you're...
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm a quick check guy, not a Wawa guy.
Thank you very much, yes.
Although I do like a good Wawa.
Right. It's actually very good. But you kind of cut your teeth cooking or starting out in Asbury Park. What was your experience there?
Yeah, actually, and that was a little bit later in my career. My first job was working with the Short Hills Hilton. You know, I was dishwasher, prep cook, outdoor pool boy, you know, working there. I worked also in for a catering company. A friend of mine growing up, mother ran a great catering company out of Maplewood, New Jersey. And I just went around helping in that regard. So, you know, working and dining in New Jersey restaurants certainly establishes the right DNA, if you will.
And one would hope.
And now that's translated to sloppy sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, having spent years working in the world of fine dining as well, it's now my mission to combine the quality of fine dining between two pieces of bread.
So what did you do in Asbury Park, though? Since that's a kind of mythic place, not just for people from New Jersey, but... you know, anybody in a post-Springsteen world.
Yeah, right before the last recession, 2007, I was working in Asbury Park. Actually, we had taken over the original Hojo's, Howard Johnson's, right on the Asbury Park boardwalk, turned it into a 250-seat cafe, and then also reopened the top floor as Tim McClune's Supper Club. So it was an old-school, you know, supper club, gone modern, of course. And that was a phenomenal experience, really embedding myself in Asbury Park. My mother lives in Ocean Grove, which is a community right next to Asbury Park. Fascinating community, Methodist community, right, walled in. So that part, you know, Jersey Shore is as, you know, unique and it certainly is a culinary wonderland. But every single community along the Jersey Shore is like another country, right? Yeah, I mean that's where I grew up. So of course that lines who I am as a chef.
What who are your kind of chef heroes or cooking heroes?
Yeah, my cooking heroes, you know, definitely Bourdain, of course. You know, little Jersey feel right there. Carl Ruiz, who recently passed, who you know was a phenomenal chef, burgeoning star in the Food Network scene, but also just a good down to earth Jersey New York chef. You know, when I look at some of the culinary heroes beyond, you know, Jacques Pepin, we had talked about with the Howard Johnson's connection, probably.
How is you know, cuisine develops. There's a kind of old French cuisine, which I guess is the stand-in for something where you have to do everything the same way forever and ever. And that's kind of lost in, you know, in the global battle for food that people want to eat. The French had to develop nouvelle cuisine, whatnot. Can you talk about how innovation in cooking and in preparing food, how does that intersect with regulation coming down from, you know, public health authorities or whatever? Are these, which should we be following more of?
Talk to any chef and all they're going to come back to are fundamentals, right? Cooking is all about fundamentals, and fundamentals of French mother sauces, fundamentals of basic technique, and then fundamentals to even kitchen hierarchy, sanitation, flow of service, right? It's always about the fundamentals. But the primary piece of food is the ingredients that go into the food. So when you look across the landscape, the culinary landscape, and you see what's hot and what's popular, and there's a lot of kind of cliches, and there's also a lot of people trying to be a bit avant-garde and going over the top just to get that quick flash in a pan, pun intended. But really, the chefs that are doing something new are only focusing on ingredients, and they're getting the highest quality ingredients, but they're also getting the freshest and the newest ingredients, and it comes down to the soil. So when we bring the idea of regulation into the growth of food, new cuisines, quality of food, it's all about having high quality food that's unadulterated, right? It doesn't have to go through the system of government, which effectively pulls not just flavor out of the food, it pulls art out of the food, and you're left with cardboard. And what we've seen over the decades is we've seen the quality of food, and let's use an apple, as it just gets constantly modified, genetically modified in many cases, in order to make it more transportable, in order to make it more approachable, right? I mean, we think about shape when it comes to food, is we've actually lost not just the nutrition, but the quality of the food, right?
It's kind of exciting that there are whole services now that will take ugly produce mm-hmm. and sell it to people, right?
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
It, for whatever reason, doesn't show up at an Albertsons or a Kroger's or whatever. What do you think is, and I think you're 40, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Compared to 20 years ago. You know, much less 50 years ago, American food offerings at every level is just so much better or more varied. I mean, there's bad stuff, but there's great stuff. What's driving, you know, that kind of renaissance and revolution? And, you know, it's a perpetual revolution in new, interesting, weird, fun stuff. Sometimes it's a return to basics. Sometimes it's coming up with something totally different. What's driving that in America?
Well, I think what nowadays, what drives a lot of food innovation is media and social media. And that's somewhat of a vanity arena. And that's good and bad, right? It gets people to be more aware of their food. It gets people to go out more to basically say, look where I am, look what I ate, look what I did. But at the same rate, it's very surface level. So I think that we're seeing a change across the food landscape because of that element of it. But I still think, once again, deep down, I come down to the fundamentals and I come down to the ingredients. And what's driving chefs who are artists to be able to create new dishes and create new genres of food is trying to find new ways to take high, high, high quality ingredients and present them to the diner in a different, literally a different vessel and figuratively a different arena.
Well, one of the things, you left the East Coast, came to the West Coast. You were involved in aquaculture. You talk about a kind of responsible open water aquaculture. What were you doing, and why do you think that's a promising way forward for increasing both, you know, fisheries, but also kind of the American palate?
Well, the ocean is everything, right? I mean, you can take any topic and you can bring it back to the ocean.
Okay, we are going to work on the Manson family murders and the Kennedy assassination maybe later, but... So yeah. Talk about the ocean.
Well, psychosis and depression are a result of not having enough omega-3s and okay. DHAs in your diet, which specifically come from seafood. So let's talk about the ocean. Let's talk about the ocean economy. Number one, it's still the Wild West, all right? It is not regulated the same way that terrestrial farming is. And by that, I'm referring to both aquaculture and wild capture fisheries. What we also saw over the past 50 years is the most positive and amazing display of ocean resilience. So when I talk about overfishing, right, which is really simple, it's basically taking a specific seafood species to virtual extinction or commercial extinction because it can't reproduce anymore. We overfished it. And we saw that in the 80s with cod, Atlantic cod fishery, which was the biggest fishery in the world at one point. We saw it with swordfish, right? If you remember that campaign, give swordfish a break. So a lot of government agencies, and this is where government can do good, they came in and they started to do a lot of science on the ocean. They said, okay, we understand that the biomass of this particular species is X. In order for it to hit its maximum sustainable yield, we can only catch Y amount each year, and then there are these fishing quotas, right? And you have these private fishermen who go out, and then obviously they can only catch a certain amount, which then force them to digress into other fisheries, right? It really diversified the fishing industry, and that was a great thing. And what we saw was success, right? Now that particular swordfish fishery is at its maximum sustainable yield. Atlantic cod, the fishery has been refreshed. That is about ocean resilience. We don't use the ocean enough in order to solve some of our environmental problems that we've created on land. Those are success stories, but instead we're just browbeaten day in and day out with this fear that we're going to run out of seafood by 2050. There was a study, it was it Boris Worm who did this? Seafood's going to be, and Ted Danson did a huge, huge piece on it. And it was about how we're going to overfish the ocean, we're going to be eating jellyfish by 2050. Well, the study was junk. It was junk science, never even came close to it, and it didn't happen. The reason that it didn't happen, and I'm going far and wide to get to my point, the reason it didn't happen is because of the presence of aquaculture. 55-60% of the seafood consumed worldwide is because of aquaculture, and specifically open ocean aquaculture. Behind oil and automobiles, one of the largest trade deficits in the United States is actually seafood. We import 80%+ of the seafood that we consume here in the United States. Well, why do we do that? Is because we're importing farmed seafood. Well, why are we importing farmed seafood? Because we don't have the framework for an open ocean aquaculture policy
and
here
so
in the United States.
And so that's creating farms that are out in the ocean.
Yep.
And so that solves a lot of problems, right?
Because yeah, well, the farming of fish, it decreases the pressure off the wild stock. So you still now have the economic viability of a wild fishery, wild capture fisheries, right? And then because they're catching a lot less, now there's the innovation, the technological innovation associated with farming fish and being efficient at farming fish in the open ocean. So when they started farming fish in the 80s, right, the amount of feed that you needed wild fish in order to feed farm fish, the ratio was like for every pound of farm fish you would grow, it was 5 pounds of wild fish you'd have to catch, right? That feed conversion ratio is incredibly inefficient. Why farm fish if you're taking more wild fish to feed the farm fish? Well, nowadays, the feed conversion ratio is like 0.5 to 1. I mean, the efficiency that we've reached is unbelievable. This is all being done outside of U.S. waters.
Aquaculture, though, open ocean aquaculture is controversial among certain types of foodies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that merely kind of personal interest or economic interest masquerading as a public health concern, or is there something to that?
It's both. So it's just mainly it's misinformation. The hysteria, the sensationalism in the press related to the fear of the danger of aquaculture and farmed seafood is unbelievable. And there was billions of dollars that have been poured into a demarketing campaign to demarket aquaculture. And I don't want to point out any particular agencies that's done this.
It would be nice if you did, though.
Well,
Name names.
Well, just follow the money. In the beginning, the Alaskan Seafood Marketing Institute was putting tons of money into demarketing farmed seafood because their number one export, of course, wild salmon, was now competing with a farmed Atlantic salmon, which was being farmed at a cost much lower than it takes to capture, process, and sell the wild species. Now, as a chef, they're two totally different species. Atlantic salmon, farmed Atlantic salmon compared to a wild Alaskan fish is an apple to a banana, right? Two totally different species. No reason to be demarketing one versus the other. If you actually had invested in promoting farmed Atlantic salmon, all boats rise with a high tide, right? Higher seafood consumption. But I will say this, because of that and all of the fear mongering and the fact that farmed seafood is going to kill you, and then furthermore, PCBs and mercury and all of these sensationalized stories, our per capita consumption of seafood in the United States is one of the lowest of most countries. As a result of that, what do we eat? Chicken, beef. What do they eat? corn, soy, high in omega-6 fatty acids. Having an overabundance of omega-6 fatty acids in your diet leads to things like hypertension, heart failure, all of these health deficiencies because we're eating junk food. We're putting junk into our bodies. There's a lack of DHA, omega-3 fatty acids, that can only be found in high-quality seafood. Six of the eight leading causes of death in the U.S. can be alleviated through regular consumption of the right omega-3 fatty acids. So these headlines have now forced people to eat less seafood. They're so confused about it. They get up to the lunch counter. It's like, well, just give me the chicken, right? Give me the chicken. So we now have the real pandemic that's underneath the pandemic we're in right now is the health crisis in America, obesity, what's in our diets, the lack of nutrition in our food, the hollow food that we're eating. And that's been perpetuated by an overregulated food system. And the food system has now been consolidated into the government, right? So it's basically corporatism at its worst, done through food. And that's what's being fed to kids. That's what's being fed because it's economically more viable to and financially for the economy to be able to mass produce crap food than to buy something locally from a local farmer's market, right? And I've heard on many occasions economists make the argument about comparative advantage. Well, if I buy this tomato locally and it costs $3 to grow and sell this tomato here locally, or I could buy the same tomato, you know, that's shipped in, mass produced in Mexico for a dollar, technically doesn't that mean that I can have the tomato and still have an extra $2 to spend in my local economy? So that actually helps the economy. Well, that argument is flawed. And the reason why it's flawed is because of the quality of the tomato they're bringing in is not the same quality. In addition to the fact that the social element of buying local, eating local, commingling locally by going to the farmer's market, right? When's the last time you saw somebody at an Albertsons sitting around having a political conversation, sipping on an espresso?
How do you have fresh seafood in Missouri?
Well, actually, most, if not 99% of all seafood is frozen at sea. So there still isn't regulation associated with fresh versus frozen. All sushi has to be frozen. That's how they kill the parasites. So once again, the idea that frozen seafood is a bad thing has been implanted in our minds. I always look for frozen seafood. I'll take the frozen seafood any day because it's been pulled out of the water, flash frozen, right? And when you thaw it, it's basically unfreezing time. Do you want that or do you want the piece of fish that's, you know, 3 weeks
on a slow
decomposed?
Coming in, yeah. So let me ask you a personal question. Andrew Gruhl, what kind of, is your real name Lipschitz? Like, where does that name come from?
I wish my last name was mayonnaise or ketchup, something in the condiment category. Yeah. So Gruhl is a German name, French-German. They don't know exactly where it started. And, you know, I can only imagine. At some point in my family, we were scooping porridge for soldiers somewhere.
Do you get a lot of jokes made about that?
Oh my God! It's culinary school was the greatest.
Yeah.
So you know, Chef Gruhl, that
You're
was always
a,
the last.
Johnson and Wales, proud Johnson and Wales grad.
Yes, yes. So. I went to Johnson and Wales. Before I went to Johnson and Wales, I went to a small liberal arts college up in Maine, Bates College.
Oh yeah.
You know, protested capitalism and smoked pot.
So what flipped you then? Was it the pot or was it owning your business that made you become a capitalist?
Well, I mean, my first real foray into understanding business was marijuana. Mm-hmm. Because in Maine, you've got an agrarian economy and then you have three incredibly expensive liberal arts colleges, Colby, Bates, and Bowdoin, all within this, you know, kind of 45, 50 mile radius. And incredibly wealthy kids that go to school there. Mind you, I went on a running scholarship and I was just a Jersey kid, blue collar Jersey kid. And you have all these kids who they want to smoke pot. And Maine has always been very decriminalized, if you will. So what was the first thing I saw was I saw a need. And I was a long distance runner. I wasn't a pot smoker at all, right? But I saw a need. And the greatest thing was, you know, you don't get high on your own supply. So I was the prime candidate to be able to address their business needs.
Oh, that's amazing. You know, as we, final question, you know, as we seem to be coming out of the pandemic, one of the problems with crises is that they institute a lot of policies that last forever. So, you know, there's a reason why we're taking our shoes off, you know, 20 years after 9/11. You know, and oftentimes the policies have nothing to do with safety or anything. What are a couple of regulations that you really want to see go away that were implemented over the last year?
Yep. Well, that's a great point that you bring up. And I'll act really quickly before I answer that, I'll also ask another question back, more just pose it. But are there any scenarios with policy, whereby there's been regulations put in place in our everyday lives, hundreds of them, thousands of them, and then they've been removed. You talk about the shoe thing. I just don't know a story.
So, well, this here's a question for you. You know, you mentioned before the kind of takeaway liquor sales and the idea, you know, that stores would sell pre-made cocktails or you would be allowed to drink out on the sidewalks and stuff. And in many cases, you know, the laws governing alcohol consumption go back to the colonial period. Do you think there's, do you think some of those laws that kind of loosen things up, do you think they'll stick around or will those be pulled back and the old laws put in place?
Yeah, I think that the areas where the laws have now been loosened, they're going to get tightened up again, right? So specifically alcohol sales, the ability to take out alcohol, this gray area now between the various types of liquor licenses here in California where you can do some things that you otherwise weren't able to do, that's all going to go away.
Which is also something that I don't think, I know I don't fully understand it when I talk to restaurateurs, the gradations of alcohol licenses in every state in the country, and they're different sometimes county by county, of what you're allowed to sell, you know, even within a restaurant, is just bewildering.
When you have a beer and wine license here in California, you actually have, you cannot serve just rice. That doesn't count as food. You actually need something that's been cooked over a specific device that that requires a hood, right? So if I have pokey and rice and that's my meal, that doesn't count as food by the California standards, and I wouldn't be able to have my beer and wine license.
That's amazing. So what are the worst laws that you hope do go away that have been put in place just in the past year of the pandemic?
Oh boy, that's a good question. You know, well, first and foremost, I think that one thing that's been great for restaurants through the pandemic has been the access to capital, right? And one of the reasons why we're seeing a destruction of small independent restaurants throughout America before the pandemic was just there was no access to capital. The only people who had the capital were the big private equity firms or family funds. You know, SBA does nothing for small businesses when it comes to restaurants. The only way you can get an SBA loan is if you actually have the money to back it, right? So
then you don't need the SBA.
Exactly. So the access to capital, that's been huge. And I hope that that remains because that will help small independent
restaurants. Where is that coming from?
Well, it's just all been loosened up. I mean, whether it's through the PPP itself specifically or any of these new stimulus programs that have been introduced through the restaurant or the rescue relief plans, those have been helpful and I think will continue to be helpful. Now, the only fear that I have is all of this money has been earmarked, but it's being distributed through government agencies. And what we know is that it's like, you know, I make the joke is that you take a cup of mayonnaise, right? And you eventually want to transfer it from one cup across to 10 cups. Well, by the time you get to that final cup, you got half the mayonnaise in there because it's stuck to the sides of this cup. That's government, right? The money's going to stick to the sides of government very quickly, and we're not going to actually see all of that money. So I go back to the, I'm bouncing around here, but you asked about the fund. We've raised almost $400,000, and we've distributed it within 24 hours of receiving it. Every single penny, if not more, because we've been matching some of that, my wife and I, as we kind of go through week by week. You look at unemployment, who the hell knows where that money's going, right? I mean, you've got some jabroni in jail up here who's getting, you know, unemployment checks, and my employees, or some of them, are still waiting on their checks from when we laid them off in April. So if we can start to see some of this money that is being printed, which really is, you know, where's this money coming from? But if that money actually is distributed directly to businesses and to people, as opposed to going through government agencies, then I actually think that it will be helpful to the economy. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
You had a spectacular rant against Gavin Newsom. Summarize it, or do the Cliff Notes version of it.
Yeah, and totally unplanned. It was standing in the kitchen. My kids were in the background. We had just heard that they were going to shut down outdoor dining. And I handed my phone to my wife, and I was like, you just got to record this. I got to say this, right? And effectively, to summarize it, it was that, you know, we can get on airplanes. We can have people piled on top of one another at Walmart, Costco, Target, any one of these big box stores. And then 400 meters down the road, I can't have people eating outside at my restaurant with tables 10 foot apart from each other while Gavin Newsom is obviously breaking all of his own rules, dining at the French Laundry with 15 people, his own health czar, after the day before lying and saying, oh, no, I dined outdoors. And then the pictures came out. The absurdity is just unbelievable.
What happened, you know, shortly after that?
So about 4 or 5 days after my little social media rant against Newsom, we got served by the Labor Commissioner a full blanket investigation on every single business that I'm associated with. Absolutely no trigger, no specific complaint. We've never had a labor law violation. There is no basis in this random investigation. And furthermore, the investigation is happening at a time where everybody knows the restaurant industry is crushed, right? So this investigation comes down. We've had to spend now well over $20,000 on legal fees in trying to provide 3 years of documentation on every single business they've asked. We've turned that around within 5-6 days, hours and hours and hours of work, still to absolutely no response as to what triggered the investigation, what have you.
It's political targeting. How long will it take for that to be resolved, you know?
I have absolutely no idea. And it's been looming. I mean, it keeps us awake at night because of the fact that there is absolutely nothing that we can do. There's no logic, no reason behind any of this. And furthermore, if they just toss it to the side, it's not like my legal fees are going to be covered. It's the bureaucratic red tape that they use if you speak out against the institution of government here in California.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Chef Andrew Gruhl, proprietor of Slapfish, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.